Secretary Treasurer of Teamsters Local 808, addressing Sunday's march to end fossil fuels in New York City, where some 75,000 protesters took to the streets with her message for world leaders coming to the UN General Assembly this week. But the banner across the rally stage read, "Biden, end fossil fuels." It was the largest U.S. climate mobilization in years. That does it for our show. Special thanks to Laura Bastios and Messiah Rhodes. Democracy Now! Is produced with Renee Feltz, Mike Burke, Dina Guzder, Messiah Rhodes, Noreen Sheikh, Maria Tarasena, Tammy Warrenoff, Tarina Nadura, Sam Alkoff, Tamari Astudio, John Hamilton, Ravi Karan, Hani Masood, and Sanji Lopez. Our executive director is Julie Crosby. Special thanks to Becca Staley, John Randolph, Paul Powell, Mike DeFilippo, Miguel Noguera, Hugh Grant, Dennis Moynihan. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.
This is Roxanne Dunbar Ortiz, and this is KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. KBOO's Board of Directors meets on the fourth Monday of the month at 6 p.m. This month's meeting will be held at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland and online through a public video conference. Masks and proof of vaccination are required at this time. A public link and phone number to attend the meeting virtually can be found on our website at kboo.fm. Please visit our website to verify if a meeting is being held.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, Oregon's gun control measure 114 is on trial this week in Harney County. A campaign emerges to recriminalize drug use, and OHSU nurses vote to authorize a strike. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Monday, September 18th, 2023. I'm Althea Billings. Oregon's gun control measure 114 is getting its day in court in Harney County in the southeastern part of the state. 114 was passed by voters in November, but has been temporarily blocked by Judge Robert Roscio since then. The judge responded to a lawsuit from gun owners arguing the new law infringed on their right to bear arms in the Oregon Constitution. Measure 114 is also one of the first gun control laws passed after new Supreme Court guidance on how judges should evaluate challenges to them. Now, judges are only supposed to consider whether the law is consistent with the country's, quote, historical traditions of firearm regulations, and not concern themselves with public interests like promoting safety. The Harney County case will be taking place over the next 6 days. The measure was also challenged in federal court, but a judge ruled in July that the measure was lawful under the U.S. Constitution. That ruling has since been appealed. Measure 114 would ban large-capacity magazines and require background checks and permits before a gun could be purchased. In 2020, Oregon voters passed Measure 110, the drug decriminalization measure aiming to treat addiction as a health problem rather than a criminal one. 3 years later, a group is proposing an overhaul of that ballot measure, recriminalizing drugs. The group calls itself Coalition to Fix and Improve Ballot Measure 110, and it's got the backing of some of Oregon's wealthiest people. Nike founder Phil Knight, Columbia Sportswear CEO Tim Boyle, and real estate heir Jordan Snitzer are three who have already donated to the campaign. There are two versions of this proposal from the group. One would make it a misdemeanor to possess hard drugs or use them in public, and mandate treatment for, quote, drug-dependent people who are charged with low-level crimes. The other version has all those same aspects, plus automatic record expungement following addiction treatment, increased penalties for repeat dealers, and an administrative overhaul. It would transfer the oversight out of the hands of the Oregon Health Authority to the Alcohol and Drug Policy Commission. Measure 110's rollout was lacking, according to an audit earlier this year, placing the blame at the feet of the Oregon Health Authority. It's not clear yet what the shift would mean for funding for existing programs. The group plans to first pitch it at the 2024 legislative short session, and if that doesn't gain traction, take it to the voters in 2024. The hunger of many Oregonians is in the spotlight during Hunger Action Month this September. People continue to struggle, even as pandemic aid subsides. Eric Tegedoff reports.
September is Hunger Action Month, and many Oregonians are struggling to get the food they need. At their annual State of Hunger address, CEO of Oregon Food Bank, Susanna Morgan, said more than a million people are expected to seek emergency food assistance through their network. She says despite the worst days of the pandemic coming to a close, people are struggling for other reasons.
We hear time and time again from parents, seniors, and young people alike that food and housing prices are still too high to make ends meet, with the type of jobs and pay that are available, let alone for folks on fixed incomes like Social Security.
Morgan says federal food assistance, the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, or SNAP, is the most important in the fight against hunger because of its scale. However, expanded pandemic benefits ended in March. A recent study found SNAP recipients experienced a 21% increase in food insufficiency after the increase ended. Vicki Schwafferman with Oregon Food Bank says making sure food is available and affordable for everyone is crucial to food justice.
Food justice is dismantling systemic barriers that lead to people of color, immigrants and refugees, single moms and caregivers, and our gender expansive neighbors experiencing hunger at a disproportionately high rate.
Morgan notes that other factors contribute to hunger, such as the increasing of wildfires and other climate disasters.
Simply the truth that climate change and climate disruptions are causing hunger, and the need for support here and across the country is real.
For Oregon News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
Unionized nurses at Oregon Health and Science University, or OHSU, have voted to authorize a strike. That comes from a press conference held by the union, the Oregon Nurses Association, this morning. The vote gives union leaders the right to declare a strike, though they aren't going that far yet. If they do go on strike, they would have to give the hospital a 10-day notice before one can start. The nurses' contract expired in June, and they've been in negotiations with the hospital since December of last year. Nurses say they want a contract that improves workplace safety, sets safe staffing ratios, and gives them the opportunity to reopen negotiations if OHSU acquires Legacy Health System. The last time nurses went on strike at OHSU, it was 2001, and that lasted 56 days. They're not the only healthcare workers to authorize a strike in the past week. Kaiser Permanente healthcare and building workers, represented by SEIU, voted overwhelmingly to authorize a strike in Oregon, Washington, California, and Colorado. Some 600,000 workers could strike, with many of the same issues at play, safe staffing levels and workplace safety. Their deadline is September 30th. Coyote killing contests are now illegal in Oregon. That's according to a new vote from the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife on Friday. They voted in new rules to ban contests to kill coyotes or other unprotected mammals that are native to Oregon. In these contests, participants compete for prizes to kill certain animals during a restricted time period. The goal is usually to protect livestock, but studies show that killing coyotes can actually increase livestock deaths because it encourages coyotes to breed more. Misinformation online is a big and hard to solve issue, but one local expert says a variety of strategies used in tandem could help. Eric Tegedoff has more on the story.
The battle against misinformation on the internet is formidable, but researchers have found some tactics that could help mitigate it. Jevin West is an associate professor in the Information School at the University of Washington and a co-founder of the school's Center for an Informed Public. He's also the co-creator of a digital literacy course, aptly named Calling BS. West says one strategy for fighting misinformation is something he puts on a sticker for his students. Think more, share less.
Just a very simple little statement, which is think more, so sort of take a little bit more time to source things before you share it, and then just share less. So think more, share less.
Another method for lessening the impact of misinformation is inoculation. That is, helping people on social media better recognize false information when they see it. West, a former biologist, says he and his colleagues mapped misinformation based on a contagion model.
So it's similar to the types of models that epidemiologists use. It's a very simple model. It's a model of spreading dynamics, which could be a viral particle or it could be misinformation cascades.
From there, he could look at the impacts of potential interventions to slow the spread. He found a combination of interventions, such as fact-checking and accuracy nudges, could cut the volume of misinformation by half. West says there's no single solution, noting society as a whole will ultimately be responsible for coming up with strategies that reduce the spread of misinformation. But he believes it will require some effort from governments.
Some people would say the government can't be an arbiter of truth, and that's true, but they can at least create the environment in which educators, for example, and journalists and others can come together and try to figure out how to make us all better consumers of information.
Just over half of Americans believe the U.S. government should take steps to restrict false information online, according to a Pew Research Center study out this summer. For Washington News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff. This story was produced with original reporting by M. Mitchell Waldrop for the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences.
All U.S. states along the Mexico border suffered consequences from the wall former President Donald Trump attempted to build, including permanent changes in New Mexico. A recent report by the Government Accountability Office, a nonpartisan government watchdog, showed wall construction desecrated indigenous cultural sites, hurt wildlife, and destroyed vegetation. Ros Brown has more.
The unprecedented attempt to build a wall along the U.S.-Mexico border has had devastating impacts on wildlife from which they may not recover, according to a New Mexico wildlife expert. The Trump administration spent an estimated $15 billion constructing more than 400 miles of wall, much of which replaced smaller existing barriers. Brian Bird with Defenders of Wildlife says construction fragmented wildlife habitats and cut off species migration routes. Because geography and private land ownership in Texas and Arizona slowed the effort, Bird says much of what was only vehicle barrier in New Mexico is now permanent.
Unfortunately, New Mexico ended up getting the brunt of the border wall construction, and in fact, other than the boot heel, most of the border between Mexico and New Mexico is walled now.
A recent report by the Government Accountability Office, a nonpartisan government watchdog, showed wall construction desecrated indigenous cultural sites, hurt wildlife, and destroyed vegetation. Bird says webcam feeds are now documenting how much more difficult the wall has made it for wildlife to cross the international border, where many species already were imperiled.
The ocelot, the Mexican gray wolf, the jaguar, the Cactus fruticans pygmy owl, all of these species are on the verge of extinction, and this border wall may have been the nail in the coffin.
Multiple erosion and flooding hazards were created by construction of the wall, which he says is already showing signs of deterioration.
Not only was it incredibly, historically expensive and a burden on the taxpayer to build it, but now you got to maintain it. And if you do not spend a lot of money maintaining it, it's going to fall down.
The Biden administration has been criticized for floodgates being left open along the border wall, which allowed some illegal immigrants to enter. But the U.S. Border Patrol took responsibility, noting the gates have always been open during monsoon season to prevent flooding and keep the wall from falling over. This is Ros Brown, New Mexico News Connection.
House Minority Leader Hakeem Jeffries says the House GOP is in a civil war. Trump questions the validity of American democracy, and the Texas Senate acquits Attorney General Ken Paxton. With more on these stories, it's Alex Gonzalez with 2023 Talks.
Welcome to 2023 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
A shutdown would only give strength to the Democrats. It would give the power to Biden. It wouldn't pay our troops. It wouldn't pay our border agents. More people would be coming across.
Speaker of the House Kevin McCarthy says his caucus is making progress on avoiding a government shutdown at the end of the month. He says the continuing resolution he hopes to pass this week would include a provision on border security. New York Democrat and House Minority Leader Hakeem Jeffries says Republicans have been on the verge of a civil war.
And we urge our Republican colleagues in the House to join us. Stop fighting each other in the reckless, reprehensible Republican civil war, and let's get to the business of the American people.
Over the weekend, former President Donald Trump told NBC News he doesn't consider the U.S. to have much of a democracy right now.
They indict their political opponent. Free speech is shot because the press is very dishonest.
Trump's remark sparked a reaction from former New Jersey governor and Republican presidential rival Chris Christie. Christie tweeted that the U.S. is the world's greatest democracy and called Trump a coward for dodging accountability. Texas Republican Attorney General Ken Paxton is back at his job after surviving a trial in the state Senate. A majority of state House Republicans voted to impeach Paxton on bribery and corruption charges, but Senate Republicans voted to acquit on all 16 articles. Democratic State Representative Ann Johnson called Paxton the most corrupt politician in Texas.
And the Republicans in the Texas Senate just returned him to the office of top cop. I will rely on what I said on the floor of the Texas House. God help us.
Increasing political polarization has led to calls for more civics education in schools. Maria Manis Payne Show with the nonprofit New Hampshire Civics says it could make public life better.
We are a very fortunate nation to be living in a democracy and have the freedoms that we have. But we also need to nurture, maintain, and make sure that we sustain them.
New Hampshire Governor Chris Sununu will join students and community members tonight in Concord to discuss civic health. Yesterday was Constitution Day. President of the National Constitution Center, Jeffrey Rosen, says making changes to the Constitution is designed to be difficult. But he points to one proposal to force Congress to balance its budget yearly, limit spending below a fifth of GDP, and require supermajority votes to raise taxes or increase the debt ceiling.
There are quite a number of states, more than the majority, that have called for a balanced budget amendment, and that amendment is within fighting distance of getting the three quarters necessary to call a convention.
A House Judiciary Subcommittee will hold a hearing tomorrow on a balanced budget amendment, as well as a different one limiting terms in Congress. I'm Alex Gonzalez for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for KBOO News in Depth. Tonight, we interview the executive director of the Regional Arts and Culture Council about what the organization will do in the face of the city of Portland withdrawing financial support. At 6, it's Labor Radio. At 6:30, Prison Pipeline. Then at 7, Hard Knock Radio. Tonight's weather will be cloudy with a low of 54. Tomorrow's weather will be partly sunny with a high of 71. Today in history, in 2001, the first anthrax letters were mailed from Trenton, New Jersey in the 2001 anthrax attacks. The quote of the day is from pop artist Roy Lichtenstein, who said, quote, "The importance of art is in the process of doing it, in the learning experience where the artist interacts with whatever is being made." Wildfire smoke is becoming more and more of an issue. On the Nez Perce Reservation, the tribe supplies air purifiers to those who are most vulnerable to wildfire smoke. With that story and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. On the Nez Perce Reservation in north central Idaho, wildfire smoke often pollutes the air. It can also seep into homes, so the tribe is handing out about 250 air cleaners to elders and others with health problems. Rachel Cohen of the Mountain West News Bureau reports.
On a recent Thursday, John Abulafentis of the tribe's air quality department was off to set up one of the air cleaners. She stopped in at the apartment of Elder Florine Davis.
Did that turn it off?
Nope. It's that you have it on low now.
Davis is 91. She mentors kids and college students in Nimi Putimt, the Nez Perce language.
You'll be like a young girl, air flying through your hair.
Davis says earlier this summer, she was traveling to a doctor's appointment in Washington State. Smoke was drifting down from British Columbia.
We could feel it. Noticing the air was a little more heavy.
This Nez Perce program is innovative and aims to protect people from wildfire smoke indoors. Aaron McTeague with the EPA says tribal efforts like this are being replicated elsewhere.
Some of these reservations are highly impacted by smoke, have lots of forested land that they're trying to manage, have a lot of vulnerable individuals.
And moving away is not an option.
Whether people like it or not, this is our home.
Aaron Miles is the director of natural resources for the Nez Perce tribe, which was forcibly removed off most of its homelands. He says the U.S. government has an obligation to ensure clean air for the tribe. At the same time,
the tribal government does everything it can to protect our people.
That includes programs like this one to ensure indoor spaces are healthy. It's been smoky a few times since the air purifier has been running in Davis's living room. She's noticed its button turn red as it's detected poor air quality and then started running its fans more intensely. She's glad to have it with her, keeping the air clean. I'm Rachel Cohen.
More processing and tribal meat inspection. That's what officials who are tasked with getting bison into Native communities say are needed in the next farm bill. South Dakota Public Broadcasting's Lee Strubinger has more.
Troy Heinert is the executive director of the Intertribal Buffalo Council. He says tribal entities need to be a part of the farm bill conversation.
You know, oftentimes we're either an afterthought or we're completely neglected in some of those decisions.
Heinert says that's shifting. The former South Dakota Democratic state lawmaker says he's seeing federal farm bill language getting drafted to help meet the needs for buffalo processing.
There's such a bottleneck in processing anyway, and then when you start talking tribes and rural nature and then buffalo on top of it, you know, those processing capabilities drop off even further.
The group works with 83 tribes across 22 states that manage over 25,000 buffalo. They expect to have relocated over 5,000 surplus buffalo to tribes in the last 3 years. Heinert, who is Suchongo Lakota from Rosebud, says tribes are asking the USDA to work with them on meat inspection as well.
There's no processing, and there's definitely no inspectors. So why shouldn't we be able to train our own people to inspect tribal meat or tribal-produced meat, and then for distribution to either our tribal membership or put it on the retail market if that's what the tribe chooses to do?
Many expect the current farm bill to get extended. South Dakota's U.S. senators hope a new farm bill will get passed by the end of the year. However, Congress must craft a budget by September 30th to avert a government shutdown. I'm Lee Strubinger.
And I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
Sleep is crucial for kids as the school year starts up again, but screen time tends to get in the way, and that can hurt mental health. Eric Tegedoff has the story.
School is back, and one way parents can set their kids up for success is ensuring screen time isn't getting in the way of sleep. Dr. Maida Chin is a professor of pediatrics at the University of Washington School of Medicine. She says there's a strong connection between sleep and mental health, and they impact each other in a circular way, which Chin says screens can exacerbate.
The screens sort of work in both directions, so that if you have underlying mental health issues, screens will worsen sleep. If you have sleep issues, it'll worsen sleep issues to the point of perhaps further triggering the development of mental health issues.
Chin notes it's not just the screens themselves that impact sleep. The content, especially on social media, can be activating. It can trigger anxiety, for instance, that makes it hard to sleep. Mental health is a major issue for youth. A CDC study found 42% of high school students felt persistently sad or hopeless in 2021. Chin believes social media heightened social isolation during the pandemic, leading to greater mental health and sleep challenges for young people. But she also points out that adults have to model the behavior they want to see in kids.
It makes no sense for us to be chastising our teens for being on their phones and on social media when they turn around and that is all they see the adults in their world doing.
To help with this issue, Chin says families don't have to change their habits all at once. She suggests having screen-free time about 30 minutes before bed, when families can instead spend time together. If media is involved, Chin says families should watch something together. For Washington News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
As part of the Biden administration's America the Beautiful initiative, the U.S. Interior Department has invested $5 million in getting buffalo back onto tribal lands. It's part of a larger program that aims to do even more. Mark Moran has the details.
The U.S. Interior Department has invested $5 million in reintroducing bison to Native American tribal lands across the country. Montana's iconic Yellowstone buffalo are playing a big part. As part of the Biden administration's America the Beautiful initiative, the money will support tribal-led efforts to bolster bison conservation efforts and help to return bison to their ancestral roots in indigenous areas across the country. Shammy Anderson with Defenders of Wildlife says the animals being reintroduced contain DNA from the iconic Yellowstone bison, the buffalo that originally roamed the plains.
These are the descendants of those animals, really the wildest of the wild. These animals tend to have big heads. They can withstand cold winters and selecting a mate and how they forage in large herds and migrate. So having this be sort of the source population, Yellowstone bison, for tribes is really helpful.
The Bison Conservation Transfer Program and Defenders of Wildlife have partnered with Yellowstone National Park, Fort Peck Tribes, and Intertribal Buffalo Council on the relocation of 284 bison on tribal lands in Plains states, but also as far north as Alaska, where pilots flew four bison to relocate in a project known as Operation Buffalo Wings. Beyond the ecological and environmental impacts of restoring bison to grasslands and plains, Anderson says there are important cultural and ceremonial reasons for indigenous people to have bison reintroduced to tribal lands too, especially for elders.
For them to bring back their buffalo on their lands and have them utilize these animals as a wildlife resource for their ceremony, for their songs, for the elders to provide that oral history. You know, it's been more than 100 years since our Native nations that have buffalo on the ground.
While the $5 million is critical to the bison reintroduction program, it is part of a larger $25 million measure introduced by Interior Secretary Deb Haaland to do even more. That legislation is pending in Congress. This is Mark Moran for Big Sky Connection.
How should we memorialize communities lost to floods? That's a question residents of a Missouri town had to answer. After repeated flooding, they took government buyouts and moved away. Dr. Anthony Lizowitz has more on the story with Climate Connections.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. In 1996, after suffering multiple floods, residents of the small community of Wakinda, Missouri, packed up and moved away. Their homes were purchased and demolished as part of a government buyout program. Today, a granite monument topped with a bell from Wakinda's Baptist Church memorializes the community that was lost and honors the lives of those who left and started over elsewhere.
The commemoration to them means that their stories are not forgotten.
Elise Zavar is an associate professor of emergency management and disaster science at the University of North Texas.
I started visiting communities that had already gone through buyouts to see what the landscapes were looking like. I was thinking, I really want to know how they're commemorating and remembering these past places.
Zavar says in her research, she found very few examples where bought-out properties had been memorialized on the landscape. But she says commemorating homes and communities that have gone through buyouts can help former residents heal.
Whether it's a tree or whether it's a plaque, a mural, whether it's people coming back and revisiting a site annually to celebrate their memories there, that's an important opportunity for us moving forward to remember where we've been and where we're going.
Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To hear more stories like this, visit climateconnections.org.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News for Monday, September 18th, 2023. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news, stories, and tips at 971-245-2158. Our remote production team for tonight's newscast includes David Rosenberg. The producer is Althea Billings, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Alex Gonzalez, Eric Tegadoff, Antonia Gonzalez, Mark Moran, Roz Brown, and Dr. Anthony Lizowitz. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Althea Billings. All of our KBOO programs, including the Evening News, are supported by our members. Thank you. If you would like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for KBOO News in Depth. We're speaking with the Executive Director of the Regional Arts and Culture Council.
KBOO News In Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
You're listening to KBOO News In Depth. I'm Althea Billings. In July, Portland City Commissioner Dan Ryan broke the news that the city would not be renewing its contract with the Regional Arts and Culture Council, or RAC, an independent arts organization that supplies arts education, advocacy, and artist grants across Multnomah, Washington, and Clackamas counties. It's a big deal since Portland funds about 80% of their budget. The why from Portland's end seems to be twofold. One aspect is the overhaul of Portland's city government structure that's set to be complete by January 2025. Ryan says they plan to create a city arts office instead of relying on the regional arts body. The second reason stems from last winter, when city commissioners refused to accept the financial reporting from RAC, alleging they were misspending taxpayer dollars. It's not over till it's over, though, and RAC is hosting a number of community outreach forums to educate people and push back on the Portland decision. I spoke with Regional Arts and Culture Council Executive Director Carol Tatch to learn more. Well, thank you for taking the time to talk with us. For a little bit of table setting, what is RAC?
Okay. So RAC is a wonderful organization. We are a nonprofit. We sit in the Portland metro area, so the Tri-County area, and we are an arts services agency for the region. We are a regional arts and culture council. We primarily do our work through an intergovernmental agreement with Multnomah County, Clackamas County, Washington County, Metro, and the City of Portland. And we have been doing this for 28 years. RAC was formed out of the Metropolitan Arts Commission as a community-led organization to support artists, creatives, and the arts landscape here in the region in 1995.
So the most recent news about RAC is that Portland says that they will be canceling their contract with the Arts and Culture Council. What does that mean for the organization?
Well, for RAC, it means because a significant portion of the our work is in the city of Portland, about 80%. Comes through the contract supporting our operations here, which include grant making, our public art program. We are the public art stewards for the city of Portland and Multnomah County, as well as